I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. Good Thursday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Today, the Nasdaq is trying to break a four-day losing streak as tech continues to see a rough September. Several cloud stocks are leading this morning's rebound. It is no play day for Facebook on Capitol Hill today. Got some live updates as an executive testifies on the alleged toxicity of Instagram. And then later, you know, John's not a surface level kind of guy. He's got to be there. We're live at Microsoft's headquarters in Redmond, Washington this hour, talking about hardware and the supply chain. Our feed, though, is going to begin with Facebook this morning, sharing its own heavily annotated version of two internal research reports that try to downplay any mental harm that apps like Instagram have had on teens and children. The journal's been publishing a series of articles, as you know, that allege Facebook knew of the negative impact its products have on young people and especially young girls. There's some unnerving language in those documents, including the phrase leveraging play dates, which caused a bit of Twitter beef last night between the New York Times and Facebook's policy director. The Today Show got Adam Mosseri when Facebook dropped its Instagram Kids project. Today, the Senate gets Facebook's global head of safety. And testimony happening right now on the Hill. And then there's this.
She left Facebook concerned with copies of thousands of pages of research. What don't they want you to know? The Facebook Whistleblower, only on 60 Minutes Sunday.
So, Julia, one of the questions of the morning and maybe the weekend is, will Instagram's alleged toxicity be the straw that finally breaks this camel's back? Shares are down more than 10% this month.
Well, Carl, I think the real question is, will this regulatory scrutiny of Facebook's knowledge of that toxicity push Facebook to pull back the way it targets teens and keeps teens engaged on Instagram? And can that damage Instagram's ability to grow? I mean, we've seen that Facebook has lost ground with younger viewers, younger users, and Instagram is really the place where Facebook still has that stronghold on kids. But there's a lot of competition. It's with TikTok, it's with YouTube, it's with Snap. And if you look at the statistics, Instagram and Facebook, the percentage of their user base, that is those teens, both boys and girls, is not as high as that of YouTube and others. So I think it's really a question of how important are these younger users for Instagram and Facebook's growth? And is Facebook inevitably going to lose some of them as it pulls back the strength of its engagement under this scrutiny, John?
Well, there's a question, I think, of external impacts. What do people do to Facebook? What do governments do to Facebook? What do regulators do to Facebook, if anything significant? I mean, you know, Carl, Marguerite Vestiaire was telling you that there really hasn't been much impact from fines. And then there's the question of what does Facebook do to itself? Does it feel so constrained by criticism that it gets less aggressive, that it changes strategy? Does that lead to a difference in trajectory for the stock? Because if we're just thinking about external impacts, those seem to take so long to actually play out that, you know, investors would have been wise up to this point not to react too quickly to even these serious allegations and issues at the company.
Yeah, the company's become adept, Julia, some argue, at sort of stringing this out and offering sort of innocuous lines of defense, waiting for either us to forget or for the market to find other reasons to buy. We're still a few weeks out from the quarter, the Q3 print, but I'm sure investors are going to start to ask questions about whether or not these kinds of things, the pause on kids' Instagram, for example, has an impact on guidance and their engagement guidance for the coming quarters.
Yeah, I mean, look, Carl, there are so many issues right now that Facebook is dealing with, including that issue about Apple changing its operating system to make ad targeting more challenging. And I think ultimately that might be the thing that has the biggest impact on advertising. But I think when you talk about teens, this is a longer term issue. You got to stay cool with the kids, right? That's essential to the long-term success of a social platform. And I think that that's going to be something we're going to watch. You know, I always closely watch those monthly active and daily active users in North America, because there is a sense that there is a saturation here, especially as the energy has shifted with younger people over to TikTok and Snap. So I think going forward, that's what we're going to watch. Maybe revenue is going to be more impacted by the Apple issue. But this is an issue not just for the next quarter. When you're talking about teens, this is an issue for the next 3 years, 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know if you're a marketer, if you're a company that's looking to reach digital audiences, how many choices do you really have? Like, if you're going to back off of Facebook, what, you're going to put it into YouTube? Like, they don't have any issues. You're going to do billboards. Well, not that there's anything wrong with billboards, but it's not exactly the same. Right? And there are other smaller properties. Certainly, you know, we've seen Snap do well with Snapchat. We've got, you know, there are others out there. But just in terms of raw volume, at a time when we've been talking so much about how much of the economy, how much of commerce is shifting online, you know, I don't know that absent a bombshell even bigger than this one, the revenue impact of Facebook is going to be any bigger than that summer ban. What summer was that? 2020, that everybody was supposed to be, you know, boycotting Facebook? How did that
turn out? It was a while ago. But John, what I'm talking about is something different, is that if Facebook has to make changes to its algorithms to be less sticky with younger people, longer term, does Facebook have a problem if it isn't able to have the engagement with the younger kids to show them the ads? So, yes, there is a digital duopoly. It's Google. It's Facebook. Amazon is on the rise. Keep an eye on Amazon. Remember, they own Twitch, which is super engaging with younger viewers. But I'm not saying that advertisers are going to boycott. We reached out to dozens of advertisers in the wake of that Wall Street Journal expose and asked them. None of them said yes. So I think it's more about, are you going to keep the users engaged? Because it's the engagement on the platform that ultimately drives ad revenue.
Fascinating question. As we mentioned, Facebook's down more than 10% this month. Goldman Sachs does reiterate, though, it as a buy. Managing Director Eric Sheridan joins us this morning on that call. Eric, I don't know if you've heard our conversation, but to Julia's point, you have competition. You have algos under pressure, perhaps, to be less sticky. You have advertisers looking at negative social externalities. Are these beginning to add up that in ways that would weigh on the stock?
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. And there was a lot in there. So let me try to unpack a few of those things. I do agree that I think there are elements of growth in younger users where there's a more diversified engagement base across a wide variety of apps. And you have to sort of capture as much of that growth as you possibly can. And the competitive intensity for that growth is as high as it's ever been. So that is a headwind they face. And obviously, advertising industry changes more broadly act as a headwind to revenue. We believe the way the company articulated forward guidance back in July articulated and captured a lot of that forward headwind, especially from some of the Apple changes that have been talked about. So we don't see a lot of downside to financial forecasts. We're always going to remain vigilant in terms of forward growth, especially from a younger demographic, though we have pointed out in some of our research that the older demographic is one of the fastest growing demographic on the Facebook Blue app and in Instagram. And frankly, advertising dollars align more with 40, 50, 60 plus year olds than they do with 16 year olds, especially over shorter duration periods of time. But I also do want to make the point that I think some of the forward execution that's needed by Facebook into initiatives like shopping, into initiatives like Oculus and the metaverse, into monetizing reels and video, the execution goes up as needed to sustain growth over the medium to long term there versus, let's call it, the core Blue newsfeed app that has fueled a lot of the growth over the last 3 to 5 years.
That's interesting. You know, we talked about this a bit earlier in the week with some early Facebook investors at Code. One view was that the metaverse dynamic thesis is a little bit more medium term and that even things like AI might be on a burner that is in front of that. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think the metaverse is a concept I think I would put in the medium to long term camp. When we just reinitiated coverage at Goldman 2 weeks ago, we framed the concept that over the next 3 to 10 years, we're going to move from Web 2.0 to Web 3.0. Web 3.0, the metaverse, augmented reality, AI and machine learning, the creator economy, these are all elements of Web 3.0 that I think are going to play out over a longer duration than the next, let's say, 12 to 24 months. I think executing on things like the blurring of the lines between commerce and advertising, which, by the way, you're seeing seeing all across the sector. Amazon, as Julia just mentioned, Google and what they announced at the Search On event yesterday, and more of the blurring of the lines between what's traditionally been commerce and advertising. We think that's more short to medium term, and watching execution and watching how dollars follow product innovation is probably going to lead to more money-making ideas in the sector over the shorter duration.
Yeah. Eric, stick around. I want to throw here to a soundbite from Senator Richard Blumenthal from just moments ago in this hearing, where he compares Facebook to Big Tobacco.
Facebook has taken Big Tobacco's playbook. It has hidden its own research on addiction and the toxic effects of its products. It has attempted to deceive the public and us in Congress about what it knows, and it has weaponized childhood vulnerabilities against children themselves.
This isn't the first time this comparison has been made. Of course, we heard Mark Benioff years ago say that Facebook is like social media is like cigarettes. Eric, I'm just curious at what point you think this starts to become a fundamental distraction for Facebook. When does this start to impact either operations or advertising? To my point earlier that there hasn't been a boycott on this issue yet.
Yeah, so a couple things there. We have not made the analogy between social media and Big Tobacco, so I'll leave that to the senator and his comments as opposed to weighing in there. I think if you take a further step back, look, advertisers want to align their dollars with platforms they feel are safe and that amplify their brands in a good light and with a good context. So the extent to which some of these themes proliferate over the years. You have seen boycotts before across other platforms as well, not just on Facebook. To the earlier point you made, Julia, we've been out doing our own digital advertising checks at the end of September into early October, and we're not picking up anything that would say a boycott is imminent based on some of the things the Wall Street Journal has said, but we can't ignore that. We can't be obtuse to the fact that that could pop up back on the radar screen, and we think investors are focused on it. But as of right now, we don't see anything like that out in the advertising industry from the conversations we've had.
So, Eric, what's the headline that would worry you at this point? Whether it's regulatory, legislative, something else?
You know, regulatory and legislative, I think the headlines can cause a lot of volatility in the stocks. And we want to be cognizant that this sector's general regulatory scrutiny and uncertainty is going to remain at elevated levels. That's not going away as a risk factor. We made that point recently in our initiation. However, regulatory outcomes play out over very, very long durations. And this sector, predominantly the largest names, Facebook, Alphabet, and Amazon, have seen a lot of multiple compression, especially multiple compression when measured against growth over the last 3-4 years as we've been writing and talking about a lot of these issues. So you do wonder how much of the forward pressure is already priced in. Facebook is a relatively cheap stock for something that's compounding revenue growth at 20% plus a year. There are a lot of stocks that don't grow anywhere near that level that trade well in excess of the PE multiple, especially when adjusted for cash that Facebook does. So investors somewhat are ahead of what I think the potential outcomes could be. I think the other point I would make is the outcomes typically play out over 3 to 5 year arcs, not 3 to 12 month arcs, but we're staying cognizant. I think what always worries me at the end of the day is revenue trajectory, relevance to advertisers, relevance to users, and we track that quarter in and quarter out. We don't see any cause for concern in the broader sector for that right now, but we have to stay vigilant to that.
Yeah. Coming off that tour in Q2, it's going to be a big day when they post for Q3. Eric, great to have you. We love having your help working our way through some of this. Good to see you. Eric Sheridan, great. Goldman.
Chamath Palihapitiya is fully out of Tesla, despite saying he never would be. We're talking the so-called Pied Piper of SPACs after the break. Plus, John is live at Microsoft demoing its Surface lineup. No one else is there but us. Tech Check is back in just 2 minutes.
Since last year's delivering alpha, markets up 30 to 50% is not normal.
Broadly speaking in the market, I'm a little skittish.
We expect the NASDAQ still has another 10 to 15% it can give back. interest rates and inflation are going to be persistent levels that are above what we saw pre-pandemic, and is going to continue to cause volatility in the market.
Valuations have always been quote-unquote expensive in tech and software.
Strap in. It's going to be an interesting time with both opportunities and risk.
Some cautious, hesitant comments there from some of the street's biggest investors at CNBC's Delivering Alpha conference this year, with high tech valuations mentioned several times yesterday. Mike Santoli is with us breaking down some of those themes. Mike?
Yeah, John, maybe what you might expect to hear when the market and valuations are up so much over the course of a year and a half, but over the last 4 weeks have actually reset lower, and it's been a little bit tougher sledding with, I think, a less clean bullish story behind a lot of those themes that seem pretty easy, whether it was, hey, GDP is growing 10% annualized early this year, buy everything, or it was, you know, we obviously have these huge secular winners in tech. At a time of low and negative real interest rates, you could almost pay up, more than ever before for the cash flow streams of those companies. So I think it makes sense. I also come away from a set of comments like these saying it's a net positive because it shows you there's not really a lot of excess optimism out there in the near term. People are being a little bit tactical. And of course, this is a group. You know, alpha is risk-adjusted returns. So you have to, on some level, convey that you're trying to look around the corner to the potential pitfalls as well as maybe some of the return opportunities. So on a market-wide sentiment basis, not the worst thing in the world to have people maybe a little more cautious.
Thanks so much, Mike. Now, one of the main headliners out of Delivering Alpha was Scott Wapner's sit down with Chamath Palihapitiya. He is out of China. He's, quote, pretty confident that Bitcoin has effectively replaced gold. And he's also completely reversed on one of his more famous bull calls. Take a listen.
You still have a sizable stock position in Tesla?
No.
You sold it?
Yeah.
When?
Over the last few years, we've sort of in the last year or so, particularly, you know, the prices allowed me to, again.
Surprised to hear you say that after what you just said about the company.
Well, I don't have an infinite pool of capital. You know, I'm myself. I don't raise funds. I can't go to other people. And so when I have these ideas, the money has to come from someplace.
Remember, Palihapitiya told Wapner back in January that he thought the electric car maker's stock could double or even triple again. So much for that. Now, joining us now is New Yorker contributor and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charles Duhigg. His profile on the prolific investor went viral earlier this year. Charles, thanks for joining us. What do you make of Chamath Palihapitiya's dramatic reversal on Tesla?
Well, saying back in January that Tesla is the best investment you could possibly make and the price is going to double or triple is a great thing to say to keep prices high while you're selling off all of your shares. And the thing you have to understand about Chamath is a wonderful storyteller. He's a captivating storyteller, right? That's why he's on TV. That's why he's quoted in newspaper and magazine articles. But most of what Chamath says is a story that is designed to help Chamath, either to help Chamath look good or to help Chamath make money. It's not necessarily a story that is designed to reflect the fundamentals of the economy or to help you, the investor, listening to the story, make a decision on what to do.
That's a pretty harsh criticism, but to be fair, it is worth noting that his SPACs have not done particularly well. So I would ask then, at what point does that catch up with him? Or do you think the storytelling ability is going to trump everything else?
I think the people have a relatively short memory in the short term, right? And so the fact that, for instance, Chamath, when he brought Virgin Galactic public and he said it was a fantastic investment, and then shortly thereafter dumped his entire personal stake for about $300 million, that was probably a warning sign that this is someone who isn't fully disclosive at every moment about his feelings or what he thinks he's going to do in the future. And yet when it came to Tesla, we kind of forgot that. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. Look, the reason capital markets work is because people act in their own self-interest. They go out and they try and maximize their own holdings. They try and maximize their own opportunities. And so I'm not saying that Chamath is doing anything wrong. I'm just saying that when we look at Chamath, the fact that he is so entertaining, he's so much fun to watch, he says these crazy things, and the stories always sort of make internal sense, that is not necessarily an accurate indicator of how the world is actually working, right? Your last guest from Goldman Sachs was really, really interesting and not super entertaining. He had a lot of caveats. He made a lot of claims where he said, I'm not certain if this is true. If you're in a room and there's a really good storyteller telling you what you should do with your money and someone else who's not a great storyteller and is telling you all the downsides and what he doesn't know, go listen to the boring guy to tell you how to invest your money, because he's probably going to make you more money in the long run.
Charles, put a finer point, if there is a finer point to be put on this for us. What's the difference between Chamath Palihapitiya and Warren Buffett?
I mean, I don't know the difference between them, except that Warren Buffett has many more years behind him and a more burnished legacy. You know, I mean, I think that Chamath is someone who is in the business of creating his legacy, and he's trying to be what he is, which is someone who is a media personality and knows how to use that media personality really, really well to promote stocks that he's invested in, to keep stocks high that he already owns, particularly while he's or right before he's about to sell them off. But that's fine. Look, you know, when I wrote this piece for The New Yorker, one of the things I pointed out is that new markets are created by storytellers. 5 years ago, people didn't think that SPACs was going to be something that actually existed. And it was because of Chamath and a handful of other storytellers who maybe are talking their own book and talking a little bit beyond the facts, who made everyone else believe that SPACs is something that ought to exist and something that they should invest in. Now, a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money in SPACs, right? It's very unclear that SPACs are necessarily a universally good thing for capitalism. But it is a new asset class. The same way that the creation of junk bonds by Mike Milken was the creation of a new asset class. And over time, these asset classes become normal. They become normalized. They have rules applied to them, which is what's happening in D.C. right now. And that's a good thing. It just doesn't mean that we need to celebrate the storytellers and assume that every story they're telling us is not only true, but also the same story that they've been telling for the last year, because these stories seem to change very rapidly and without much recognition that there's been an adjustment made.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, people have gone back and looked at the year to date and sort of the SPAC decline and how the peak coincided with two things, Charles. One was the Bloomberg piece in which Chamath was called the king of SPACs. Want you to know he's the next Warren Buffett. And then his own tweet, which we can't say out loud, but basically said, I'm about to really mess some stuff up, just FYI. I wonder if you think there's a correlation between Chamath's profile and valuations, or at least SPAC valuations.
Oh, of course. Of course. We are living through this, like, we're living through this amazing period where, like, literally all you need is, what, 20 or 25 people on Reddit to create a bubble in a stock and everyone else piles on board. I don't think there's anyone who's a professional investor who thinks that what's happening in the market right now is rational. And so, yes, if Chamath can move the market by tweeting a curse word without even saying what he's going to do, just tweeting a curse word that gets attention, then that would indicate that things aren't working based purely on economic fundamentals. But again, this is part of how economics works, right? This is part of how capitalism works. And it's going to crash. Everybody agrees it's going to crash. SPACs are already crashing. We already see trembles in the stock market writ large. The question is, do people pay attention to the fundamentals and make a wise choice? Or do they get so entranced by the storytellers that they miss the real knowledge when it comes along? And most of your audience, my guess is actually getting the real knowledge because they tune in to listen to what someone from Goldman Sachs says rather than going on Twitter and just saying, like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see what Chamath says next and making my investment decisions based on that.
Charles, appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, Charles' latest book, The Power of Habit, is out now. And to watch the full Chamath interview or anything else from Delivering Alpha, they're now available on demand. Just go to deliveringalpha.com. for details. John?
Yeah, and right now, Carl, I am here at Microsoft headquarters. We're going to take a closer look at the new Surface lineup, do some Windows shopping, Windows 11, talking to Yusuf Mehdi, an exec here over devices after the break. Don't go anywhere. Tech Check will be right back.
Tech Check, we are resetting here near the bottom of the hour. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Boorstin and John Fort. Markets are mixed. The Nasdaq trying to recover some life today. Tech helping lead the charge there as growth does outperform value for a change on this final day of the quarter. Let's get a news update first, though, with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. Shares of Bed Bath & Beyond trimming losses, but still down more than 20% and on track for their lowest close in a year. Second quarter profits badly missed estimates and sales sank 26%. The company CEO saying that they didn't move fast enough to raise prices and maintain margins. The company also facing supply chain challenges and lowering guidance for the rest of the year. CarMax shares sinking 11% despite posting record quarterly revenues. Investors focusing on weak earnings and profit margins, as well as the number of used cars sold. Missing estimates, CarMax shares are still up more than 35% this year. Jobless claims rising for the third week in a row. Economists blame a number of factors, including Western wildfires, Hurricane Ida, and higher levels of COVID infections. And Merck announcing an $11.5 billion deal to buy Acceleron Pharma. Acceleron focuses on treatments for respiratory and blood diseases. Acceleron shares roughly flat today, but the stock popped more than 20% last week on reports of a possible deal. You're now up to date. John, I'll send it back to you.
All right, Rahel, thank you. Microsoft making a number of hardware announcements as we're just right on the door of Q4 right now, gearing up to launch Windows 11 on Tuesday and announcing last week the biggest update to the Surface portfolio I've seen, five new devices. I'm here now with Corporate VP of Search and Devices, Yusuf Mehdi, in Redmond. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about, but everything in here has got chips in it. The supply chain has been a mess. How have you planned for that in a way that you think you're actually going to be able to deliver this stuff in Q4?
Yeah, big question, John, for sure. And let me start first just by saying how excited I am here to be with you on campus, a couple days away from what I think is going to be the biggest moment Microsoft will have this fiscal year with the ushering in of a new PC era with Windows 11. And it'll be marked by three things: more personal experience for computing, more choices for apps and devices, and a more open platform for creators and developers. To your point, demand is at an all-time high for PCs, and so we're doing everything we can. I'd say it's probably the largest mobilization of the PC ecosystem across component makers, device makers, chip makers, to try and get after and get those PCs on shelves for the holiday. But it's going to be tough. The demand is huge, and we ship 230 million PCs a year, so it'll be a real challenge.
How much does it help you that these devices in this lineup are pretty premium for the PC market overall? So, you know, that need to cover costs, maybe not as much an issue for you?
Well, it's definitely a challenge, you know, broadly, but we will do well because we do well on the high end and the premium segment, in particular with Surface, but the PCs as a whole. So, you know, economically, it's certainly a better business opportunity. But look, we'd love to fill the demand for all the customers who want those devices. And we're gonna do a lot. Even with Windows, we have over a billion people who use it regularly. We're going to make sure that we can upgrade those devices. So even if you buy a Windows 10 PC, because when a Windows 11 one's not there, we can upgrade your device with high certainty.
Let's talk strategy as you grab the studio over here. I was really impressed with the studio desktop. You've now got a laptop as well. It moves, it transforms. I had Transformers as a kid. I love that stuff. So initially, the danger with the Surface lineup was you're competing with your OEMs. But Microsoft said, no, what we're really trying to do is raise the bar and get us out of this netbook malaise that was threatening to take over the whole PC market. How have you done?
We feel we've done great. We look at success of Surface across three dimensions. The first is what you talked about. We want to inspire the ecosystem. We want to be able to build higher class, higher quality machines. Right now, we have the highest rated laptop of any device, higher than MacBooks.
Okay.
We pioneer new categories. You're holding an exciting new category of device in your hand there. That's a dual screen mobile phone, finished 5G product that's out there. 11 and, you know, sort of more pixels than an iPad 11. And then the thirdly is we think Surface is a business in its own right. And we've had great success. It's a big business. It's growing every year. For the last 4 years, double-digit growth. So we're feeling good about all of the areas. When you look at PC share in the premium segment, we've done well. And we think Surface has played a role along with our OEM partners.
Well, let's talk. This is Duo 2, right?
Yes, it is.
Now, Duo 1, I was wondering if it was even going to launch based on what was happening last year and all the questions about what the consumer was going to do. But you've got three cameras in it now, some updates to the software and how the two screens work. What's the feedback you're getting? And what is success here? Because this isn't a mainstream like competitor to Samsung or Apple, right?
That's correct, John. It's still, I would say, in the niche category. It's designed for people who love the Surface product line and who use Android a lot. But it's been a sleeper early in the pre-orders. Already, we're seeing huge demand for it because we fixed the top things that people wanted. They wanted 5G, they wanted a better camera, and they wanted more screen to be able to dual task. It's really the only device that you can launch two apps at once and lets you do some incredible scenarios like take a picture, see the picture, read your email while you're on a conference call. Really powerful. We're seeing early demand. It's, you know, it's small and building, but we're excited about that one.
I know you guys are probably hoping that this shift during the pandemic, this one shift, is durable, which is that no more one PC for the whole house, right? Everybody's got to have one, right on down to the elementary school kids. What have you learned about the components and features that people now demand out of productivity devices that are going to drive how you design them into the future?
Yeah, a great question. And that's a big part of what went into the design of Windows 11. So what we've learned over the last 18 months, as you mentioned, John, a couple of things. We're going to work hybrid probably for a long time to come. Kids are going to learn at school and at home. And as people, we're going to run our lives. So video conferencing, text chatting. We now have on the Windows shell, one button click, you can get into video conference. So that's new. We have a new news feed, productivity feed, that keep you informed throughout the day because we know you're spending time, work and life, and they're interrupting each other. And then we're doing a lot to open up the store to get more apps. And so one of the amazing things about the new Microsoft Store on Windows is you can now run Android apps soon on it. And so you can do the things that you do in life on the PC that you might be using for work, home, or education.
Quickly, Xbox. Short supply. Phil Spencer seems to be saying short supply for a long time. Are people going to be able to get one this holiday season?
It'll be tough. I mean, Xboxes, Windows 11 PCs, if you want one, I'd say, honestly, get out there and get one early.
All right. Yusuf, thanks for having me and having us from Tech Check here. Guys, Carl, back to you.
All right, John, thank you very much. In case you forgot, Salesforce was in the Dow. It was the index's top component for the quarter. Stocks up double digits in the last 3 months as people start to think about the margin story being more secular. And then watch Altria, the International Trade Commission ruling that its heated tobacco device infringes on existing patents. That stock is taking a dive this hour, down nearly 5%. Dow's down 200, and we'll get more Tech Check after this break. Fed Chair Powell, Treasury Secretary Yellen are testifying before House Financial Services today. Steve Leisman has been watching and has some highlights. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Carl. Yeah, just real quick. Fed Chair Jay Powell was just asked the question of could the Fed step in and help in the event of a default? He said the Federal Reserve cannot shield the American public. Well, on his second day of testimony in Congress, he told the House Financial Services Committee that he does not anticipate having a conflict between maximum employment and high inflation because he thinks inflation is just going to come down next year.
Right now, we're far away from, we think, full employment. So that gives us an incentive to keep accommodative policy strong, to keep accommodative policy in place. Inflation is well above target, and we have an expectation that high inflation will abate because we think the factors that are causing it are temporary and tied to the pandemic and the reopening of the economy. And what we say is we just have to balance the two.
Powell also was asked about the recent resignations of Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan and Boston's Eric Rosengren. He pledged to use the openings to try and increase diversity among the ranks of Fed presidents.
I can absolutely guarantee you that we will work hard in both of those processes to find and give a fair shot to diverse candidates for those two jobs, as we do. And it'll be a big focus of both of those processes.
Powell was not asked specifically about the conflict of interest controversy itself at the Fed that led to those resignations. And so far, he's not faced much, if any, of the high-level or really strong criticism on the level of Senator Elizabeth Warren's comment in the Senate where she called Powell, quote, a dangerous man to head the Fed. Relatively quiet, Carl, compared to that.
Yeah, although on Yellen's Q&A, Steve, that discussion from House Republicans about rental assistance, I wonder how much heat do you think she's taking on fiscal issues today?
Taking a bit of it, just by the way, said that she thinks that they should do away with the whole debt ceiling drama and not even have that debt limit at all. She's taking some, but she's parrying back, and not a lot of blows landed. The parties are where they are on these fiscal issues, and we'll see how it all comes out at the end, maybe even the end of this week, Carl.
Facebook's on the Hill today to defend how its platforms impact teens. Is Mark Zuckerberg's strategy on target? The latest on that story, plus Facebook's head of finance. That's next.
Let's get a gut check on Snowflake. BTIG takes it to buy this morning. Price target of $3.53 and forecasts big growth ahead thanks to a, quote, rapidly growing data analytics market. Stock is jumping today. Important to keep in mind, though, roads have been icy for Snowflake. It's still more than 30% off its highs of the year. We're back in 2 minutes. Don't go away.
Will you disclose all of the reports, all of the findings? Will you commit to full disclosure?
Well, I know that we've, Senator, thank you. I know that we have released a number of the reports, and we are looking to find ways to release more of this research. I want to be clear that this research is not a bombshell. It's not causal research. It's, in fact, just
Ms. Davis. This research is a bombshell. It is powerful, gripping, riveting.
This hearing has been underway for the past hour or so. Facebook's global head of safety, Antigone Davis, under attack. Senator Blackburn pushing her on whether the company is targeting kids age 8 to 12, which would be in violation of COPPA, that's the Children's Online Safety Act. Davis responded no. And then in response to questions about what Facebook did in response to all of that data in the Wall Street Journal expose, Davis saying that the research did fuel product changes, including how to report content around eating disorders. Now, there have been a lot of questions in the past hour about Facebook's interest with Instagram with kids. Davis playing defense, saying they are not currently targeting the kids market. But Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, asked Davis how they estimate the lifetime value of a user, a Facebook user, who starts using Facebook products before the age of 13. Davis would not answer that question. And then just moments ago, Senator Markey saying that pausing Instagram for kids is insufficient, asking Davis to commit to not ever launching Instagram for kids. No commitment in her response. But throughout this, there have been a number of comparisons between Facebook and tobacco. Davis saying repeatedly that Facebook's products add value, connection with friends and family. And her frequent refrain is that this is all something that we'll talk to our experts about. Now, today's hearing comes after earlier this week at the Code Conference. I sat down with Facebook's head of financial, David Marcus. We spoke about how the controversy surrounding Facebook's and its impact on teens is impacting his initiatives. We also talked about stablecoin regulation and much more. Take a listen. I have to ask you about this broader criticism of Facebook in general. We're hearing a lot about it on stage here at Co. There's a lot of regulatory oversight of Facebook right now. Does all of that impact your ability to innovate in the fintech space?
Well, it definitely does. But I still believe that when we have an opportunity to change the game for so many people who have been left behind by the current system, 1.7 billion people who are currently unbanked, over a billion people underserved by financial services, when we have that opportunity to actually build a service, in this case Novi, that can change the game for people where they can have a stable digital version of the dollar that they can send around for free around the world, then we should take that opportunity and fight for our ability to actually serve these people better. And that's what I'm doing.
And so that's what you're doing. But when you mention stablecoin, you know, we have initiatives like Tether that have moved forward. And your initiatives at Facebook, even though you were among the first to get out there and push for a stablecoin, they have not advanced as far as many had expected. Are you disappointed by how that's all gone?
I'm not disappointed. I think that, you know, we need to make the case for what is an actually good stablecoin. I think that some of them that have been out there, like the one you just named, didn't have appropriate reserves to protect consumers. And we believe that the right design involves a fully backed reserve with very high quality assets, like dollars, basically cash and short-term treasuries. And we believe that it's normal that at our scale we receive that kind of scrutiny, and we just have to answer with the appropriate things. And I think we've done all of these things. We're ready to roll now and ready to launch our wallet.
So what's the timeline here? I mean, we've seen Twitter launch the ability to tip with cryptocurrencies, which is sort of enabling this new cross-border payment systems. And now there aren't cross-border payments within Facebook. You could pay within India, within Brazil, but you can't pay across borders. What is your timeline for being able to launch some of those things?
You're absolutely right that today you cannot send money cross-border. And that's the goal of the Novi wallets that will enable people to send money cross-border. So as far as timing is concerned, we're ready on the Novi side, and we're going to see what happens in the next few weeks. But the goal is to get ready for a broader launch on the DM network when it goes live.
And so we just saw some announcements from TikTok pushing further into shopping. There was a partnership with Square. How important are payments and e-commerce, which you do oversee, these payments and e-commerce within Facebook, within Instagram, especially when it comes to small businesses in the creator economy, which is something we talk about a lot?
Well, it's very important because, as you know, many, many small businesses find their customers on Facebook and on Instagram and across our properties, and they advertise on the platform, and then they sell products and services that people want to buy. And I think that, you know, you'll see us continue to push to make that experience better for consumers and for small businesses. And payments is a big part of that, because we need to make sure that we take out all of the friction from the user experience so that small businesses can actually sell more things and consumers can have a better experience.
You've been working on this for a while, but now we're seeing all of Facebook's rivals, particularly TikTok, which just hit a new massive milestone in terms of billion users. How does all of that impact your ability to compete when you have all of these rivals really jumping into the space?
Well, I think it demonstrates that the market is, you know, more competitive than some have portrayed. And, you know, competition is good. I've always believed that competition actually brings the best out of products and services, and consumers always end up winning. So I think it's a good thing.
You can catch the full interview online at cnbc.com/techcheck. And guys, I thought it was really interesting to hear and very refreshing to hear this honesty about how challenging it is to get regulatory approval for these things, and also how much more crowded the competitive landscape has gotten since Facebook initially got into this whole stablecoin business.
Yeah, Carl, I think it's interesting to hear what he had to say about Tether. Also, you know, before we're talking about Antigone Davis, before the Senate, Facebook sent her to get buried, and the high school English student in me can't help but take note.
Julia, I am curious to know what you make of a few things. One is, we've talked about this in the last hour, what we might hear additionally from 60 Minutes on Sunday, the circularity between Senator Blackburn and Blumenthal talking about some of these issues at Senate Commerce. And then even as we're dealing with all of these regulatory landmines, you know, they're still trying to play some offense on things like Reels, moving it out to all U.S. mobile users. It's a difficult thing to do, kind of like definitely swimming upstream.
Simultaneous offense and defense. Look, I think David Marcus is right that Facebook's ability to do everything can be curtailed by all of this regulatory scrutiny. And in terms of what we learn on Sunday, I think the crux of all of this outrage and the Wall Street Journal expose and the hearing that's happening right now is this idea that Facebook knew and didn't take action on it. Maybe people already know and assume, John, that Facebook and Instagram aren't great for teens. But the crucial thing is the knowledge and the lack of action.
Right. Actual research about exactly that. Well, if you want the latest on Facebook as the story continues to unfold, you, of course, can follow and subscribe to the Tech Check podcast. Listen anytime, anywhere, wherever you download podcasts. Tech Check will be back in a moment.
You got to stay cool with the kids.
Quick programming note. Since I was here in the Seattle area, I popped in on Amazon too. Don't miss Amazon's head of devices tomorrow. We talked about how the company's been handling the supply chain. And that will be a big part of the show with Dave Limp. We also talked about Astro, the new robot. So got some hands-on time with that. And with that, let's get Carl. Where are we going?
All right. That's fantastic. John's been all over the place. You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.